Let's get started this morning. In our confession of faith, in chapter 2, speaking of the Lord our God, one of the things that we confess about God is that he is invisible. And so this morning's Sunday school is about the invisibility of God. And as I was preparing for this Sunday school and looking up some resources, trying to find helpful resources, I happened upon one that was so good, I thought, we should just read this. Why reinvent the wheel? So you may say, that's laziness. I say, that's resourcefulness. But I wouldn't just sit here and read it at you. And so I prepared it for us to read through it together. You have the full text of it in your handout, which is why if you don't have the handout, you'll be somewhat lost. And this is coming from John Arrowsmith, who was a Presbyterian minister in the 17th century. He was a member of the Westminster Assembly of Divines. He was a nonconformist, and so he is someone very much within our theological and confessional camp, we might say. And his words, his treatise, or his treatment, that's the word I'm looking for, his treatment of God's invisibility is very good. It's well organized, it's well expressed, and it has some interesting applications at the end if we get to that. As I prepared the document for you, I had to balance two things. One is font size, and the other is page count so as not to waste paper. So I did the best I could to print it at a font size that is legible and wouldn't hurt your eyes. But we're going to read through hopefully the entire thing from John Arrowsmith, his book Theanthropos, or God Made Man, Theanthropos, the God Man. This is about our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And in this book, John Arrowsmith is going through, I think it's the first 18 verses or so, or the beginning part of chapter 1 of John, the Gospel of John. And when he comes to John chapter 1 and verse 18, which says this, "No man has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he has declared him." That's where John Arrowsmith goes into a discussion of the invisibility of God. No man has seen God at any time. And so he goes through the arguments of in what ways can God be seen by man and can man see God, etc. So that's the context, is John 1:18. He's commenting on this verse in a larger exposition of the beginning of the Gospel of John. And he begins to talk about the invisibility of God. So this is everything here. These are all John Arrowsmith's words, not my own. I may pause to make a few comments of explanation as we move forward. So let's start reading. John Arrowsmith, he says this. He says, commenting on John 1:18, "You may perceive by what you read in John 9 how zealous the Jews were for Moses and how prejudicial against Christ. Then they reviled him and said, 'You are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciple. We know that God spoke unto Moses, but as for this fellow, we know him not whence he is.'" Let me make a comment about older English. They said, "But we are Moses, his disciple." That's where we get apostrophe S at the end of a word to show a possessive. You might say, "That is Sam, his car." But if you just say Sam apostrophe S, "That's Sam's car." That's just an abbreviated version of "that's Sam, his car." So that's where we get that kind of abbreviation. And it looks strange to us. But if you read it as, "But we are Moses' disciple," it reads very naturally. "As for this fellow," the Jews say of Jesus, "we don't know where he's from." And therefore the evangelist here, John, to take away this misapprehension of theirs, having in the 17th verse preferred Christ before Moses and the gospel before the law, because the Jews that spoke so much of God speaking to Moses and appearing to him were ready to object. "But God spoke face to face with Moses." Therefore, the evangelist here prefers Christ, or puts him forward or ahead, and shows a greater intimacy between God and Christ than between God and Moses. "No man has seen God at any time." No, not even Moses. "But the only begotten Son has seen God." Moses had some sight of God, but in apparition, in other words, in an appearance, a visible manifestation that God created for Moses to see. He desired to see God face to face, but was denied. Only he was not denied the sight of some similitude or likeness of God. Numbers 12, verse 8, with him will I speak mouth to mouth, even apparently and not in dark speeches, and the similitude of the Lord shall he behold. So remember, Moses enters into the Holy of Holies, and between the cherubim on top of the ark over the mercy seat, the visible glory cloud of God appeared, and Moses saw this. He beholds the likeness or the similitude of the Lord. But Christ was in the Father's bosom, and so saw him face to face as never man saw him. First, that which concerns the invisibility of God. No man has seen God at any time. For the understanding whereof you must know, that God may here be considered either in reference to his essence, seeing God in his essence, or his counsel, seeing God in his counsel. And accordingly, there is a twofold sight of God. First, a beatifical vision, and second, a scientifical vision. A beatifical vision of God in reference to his essence, and a scientifical vision of God in reference to his counsel. I dare not exclude neither of these in reference to the text, because the words which follow seem to have Christ in both. In other words, Jesus has a beatifical vision and scientifical vision of God. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father. That implies Christ to have a beatifical vision of God in his essence, even here upon the face of the earth, because he was then even in the bosom of the Father. And he must needs, or he has to, it must be true, and he must needs see the essence of God, that is, essentially, God himself. He that has the same essence with the Father must needs see the essence of the Father. He is the only begotten Son. Therefore, he has the beatifical vision of the Father. Then, he lies in the bosom of the Father. Therefore, he has the scientifical vision of the Father, too, in both which respects he was able to declare the Father or make him known. Speak we then first of this clause, no man hath seen God at any time. As it refers to the beatifical vision of God in his essence, the meaning will be this, no man, that is, no mere man, for Christ who is God-man must be accepted. No mere man has seen God, that is, God in his essence. For God in appearances has been seen by many. No man has seen God at any time, namely, during his life, during the state of mortality, so it is to be limited. That answer which God gave to Moses in Exodus 33:20, when he desired the sight of God, the Lord said, "You cannot see my face, for no man shall see me and live." You must take it in a composite sense, that is, no man upon the face of the earth shall see me, no living man, while he lives upon the face of the earth, can see the face of God in his essence. Otherwise, there is a time while men do live, and live most happily, namely, when they are in a state of glory. Then they do see the face of God, then face to face, says Paul, even as the angels. So pause for a moment. Notice that in John 1:18, or in Exodus 33, for no man shall see me and live. John Arrowsmith is saying there is a way in which man lives when he can see the face of God. So this must be speaking of man during his mortality cannot see God's face. But man after his mortality, man in immortality, can see the face of God. It is said of the angels, sorry, that's an autocorrect there of the angles. It is said of the angels that they behold the face of God, Matthew 18:20. Christ says there, I say to you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven. So when men come to be like angels, not the same thing as angels, but like angels in a state of glory, then they shall also see the face of God. But no man has seen God at any time during this life. God in his essence. For this we have more than one place of Scripture. The same words in the text are repeated in 1 John 4:12. No man hath seen God at any time. And Paul has a place to the same purpose, 1 Timothy 6:16, who only has immortality dwelling in light which no man can approach unto, whom no man has seen nor can see. There are but three ways that can be imagined by which man, in a state of mortality, can see God in his essence. Either it must be by his bodily eyes, or by the eye of reason, or by the eye of faith. But a man cannot see God by any of these. Therefore, no man can see God in that sense. First, no man can see God by his bodily eye, for the very light wherein he dwelleth is inaccessible to the eye of sense. We cannot so much as see our own souls, or the angels that are inferior spirits. How then shall we be able with our bodily eyes to see the Father of spirits, the Lord of glory? The Israelites could not so much as endure the shining of Moses, his face. How then can the eye of the body be imagined capable of that infinite glorious light that is in the essence of God? And yet there is a place that speaks as if a man in the state of mortality by his bodily eyes had seen God. Genesis 32:30, Jacob called the name of the place Penuel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. Here is a man in the state of mortality that saw God face to face. For this you must know, that Jacob did indeed see God, but God in a representation, not God in his essence. He saw the second person in the Trinity in the shape of a man that wrestled with him. This was all the sight of God that he had. The second person in the Trinity, before he took the nature of man, took the shape of man. This is not an incarnation, he's saying. Such a shape had Christ taken here, in which he wrestled with Jacob. And this is that God which Jacob saw face to face, not God in his essence, but God in a representation. And that very thing of God appearing in the Old Testament in a representation to the eyes of the body shows that he never appeared to them in his essence, because his representations are many and his essence is one. He appeared in a bush to Moses and to Elijah in a still voice, to Jacob as a wrestler, to Joshua as a captain of the Lord's host. These were all representations that God was pleased to make of himself, and thus men saw him. But his essence all this while was invisible, neither could it be diversified as his representations were, being but one. So one thing I didn't mention earlier is I like, as we proceed, how Arrowsmith connects to various of the other parts that we have been studying in our Sunday school lessons. Here he's using the simplicity of God to say you can't have diverse representations of something that's simple. God's essence is simple, so it cannot be a bunch of different things. These must be representations of God, but not his very essence. That is memorable, which Isaiah says, Isaiah 6:5, "Mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." The Jews took this advantage against him and said he was a false prophet, that Isaiah was a false prophet. Why? He said he had seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Whereas God says to Moses, "You cannot see my face and live." Therefore, they put him to death. No man can see God in his essence and live, but Isaiah saw him and he said true, but it was in a representation. We're at the top of page 3. Thank you, Campbell. Secondly, no man can see God in his essence, no, not by the eye of reason. So we've looked at the bodily eyes. You can't see God with your bodily eyes. Now the eye of reason. Reason has but three ways by which it comes to the knowledge of God. And those are known to scholars by these names: the way of causality, the way of negation, and the way of eminence. Man, where have I heard that before? Oh, it was in Sunday school. And then, for sake of time, he goes through the arguments of what these things are, and he affirms them as valid ways of knowing God by reason. But look at the end of each paragraph. So the paragraph that begins first by way of causality, skip to the end of that paragraph. So that all that reason can do this way is to gather that there is a God, but not what he is. So we know that God exists, but we don't know his essence. Secondly, there's the way of remotion or negation. And then skipping to the last part of the paragraph, but this still comes short of seeing God in his essence, for by this we see what God is not, not what he is, by this way of remotion. Third, way of eminency, skipping to the end. And yet in all these it comes short of the essence of God, because in this way it finds out what he is, rather in regard of his qualities. Speaking after the manner of men, he's saying God is simple, but we attribute diverse things to him, than what he is in his essence. Thus we cannot see God in his essence, no, not by the eye of reason. So to be clear, Arrowsmith is affirming man's true knowledge of God by reason through the threefold way. but he's saying it falls short of seeing God in his essence or knowing God in his essence. There is only one more, that is the eye of faith, which goes a great deal further into the knowledge of God than reason can. And yet we cannot apprehend God in his essence, no, not by the eye of faith. Thence it is that faith is opposed to sight. Second, he's saying, for this reason, the knowledge we have by faith is considered inferior to the knowledge we will have by sight. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7. We walk by faith and not by sight, implying that all the while we have no higher principle than faith in us, all that while we come short of God to see him face to face. 1 Corinthians 13, 12. Now we see through a glass darkly, but then, in the future, not now, face to face. Then, speaking of a time after this life, when that which is perfect is come, and that which is imperfect shall be done away. Then, face to face, not till then. Here, by the eye of faith, we see as through a glass darkly. These are two excellent expressions, though something darkened or somewhat darkened by the translation. For it is as through a glass and in a riddle. Here is the glass to the eye and the riddle to the ear. Both imply that faith gives us but a dark knowledge of God in comparison of the light of glory. What we see in a glass, we see by reflection. The angels see God face to face by direct beams. And we should pause. You have to remember that a mirror in the ancient times would not have been as crystal clear as the mirrors are now. It would have been a very polished metal, which gives a reflection. But imagine just a polished metal that it's not a very clear image. We think of a mirror as a one-to-one perfect representation. That's not what is in the mind of Paul when he talks about seeing through a glass darkly. A mirror in those times was not, they didn't have the technology to polish it to the clarity we do today. So they had a true representation, but a somewhat obscured, if not disfigured, because it's not as smooth and clear as a mirror would be today. Let's see, where were we? Okay, what we see in a glass, we see by reflection. The angels see God face to face by direct beams. We see him as in a glass, the glass of the creatures and of the scriptures. There shall be no need of these glasses in heaven, where all ordinances shall cease. We see God through ordinances, like the Lord's Supper, and God shall be all in all, but here as through a glass and as in a riddle. What men apprehend in a riddle, they may have true apprehension of it, as in the riddle that Samson put forth, but it does not convey a thing so clearly as if it were spoken in plain words. Think of Jesus' parables. Did they communicate truth? Yes, but obscured through parable or through the prophecies. It's true knowledge, but obscured. Whatsoever we see it as in a glass. Whatsoever we hear as in a riddle. But then, face to face, says the apostle, then we shall see him as he is, 1 John 3. So now you have had an explication or an explanation of this proposition according to the first sense, that no man has seen God at any time. That is, no man in the state of mortality has a beatifical vision of God in his essence. I proceed now to the second, that no man here in this mortal life attains to a scientifical vision of God in reference to his counsel. That also is proper to Christ. Compare it, if you please. I do please. John 6:46 with Luke 10:22. In John, thus of that, no man has seen the Father save he which is of God. He has seen the Father. What is that? Luke 10:22. All things are delivered to me of my Father, and no man knows who the Son is but the Father, and who the Father is but the Son, and he to whom the Son will reveal him. Seeing is usually put for knowing in Scripture, and seeing of God for the knowing of his counsel. This only Christ does, therefore called the Wonderful Counselor, Isaiah 9:6. He could not be a counselor to us in discovering the great secrets of God if he were not first privy to God's secrets. Who but Christ could have made known that way of salvation which he has opened through his own flesh to the way of heaven? It was impossible for angels or men to have found out a way to have been recovered to God when man was once fallen, had not Christ revealed it. This knowledge of God no man has, for he says, Romans 11:34, having said in verse 33, "Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable is his wisdom," he adds, "Who has known either the mind of the Lord or who hath been his counselor?" That is proper to Christ. No man may assume it. I say no more of it here because it will come in again in the next clause. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he has made him known. Come we now to the observation of the invisibility of God for application. So he said you can see God with a beatifical vision of his essence. You can see God with a scientifical knowledge of his counsel. We do not have a beatifical knowledge of God in this life, but we will in the next. And we do not have a scientifical knowledge of God's counsel in this life. Jesus makes it known to us, but no man knows it entirely of himself. Only what Jesus has made known to us. Observation and application from the invisibility of God. First, by way of reproof. We might from hence take occasion of lashing the papists in the first place. Always a fun thing to do, right? Those are his words, not mine. And in the next place, to reprove the disputers of this world, and especially the Arminians. The papists first. So why are they being reproved? For two things. In point of their idolatry, because of their idolatry, and second, their boasting of their idolatry. First, no man has seen God at any time, and yet they presume to make images of him, visible shapes of the invisible God. Deuteronomy 4:15-16, "Take ye good heed to yourselves." This is one of the scripture verses cited in our confession for the invisibility of God. "Take ye good heed to yourselves, for you saw no manner of similitude or likeness on the day that the Lord spoke unto you in Horeb out of the midst of the fire." So in other words, God is saying, you saw a glorious light of like lightning flashing in a cloud, a brilliant obscurity, but you saw no shape, no form to say, that's God. No, you just saw a glorious apparition, a glorious appearance, and a voice that emanated from it. "Take ye good heed, lest you corrupt yourselves and make you a graven image, the similitude of any figure, the likeness of male or female. If we will be worshiping any image of God, let us worship Christ, who is the express image of his Father's person. And no image of God but Christ may be worshipped." He's not talking about worshiping icons of Christ. He's saying that the incarnation is God made visible to us, and we do worship Christ in the flesh. He's not talking about icons of Christ or visible representations of him. They, the papists, were wont, they tended to, it was their practice, to kiss their images of old. Ye know, ye is you plural, ye know what God says of so many souls who have not bowed the knee to Baal, nor kissed him. In reference to this, kiss the Son, Psalm 2, no man has seen God at any time. So if they say, well, Psalm 2 says kiss the Son, then he's responding, no man has seen God at any time. Your icon of Christ is not Christ. And yet, if you believe them, they tell you strange stories of some of their grandees that have seen the Blessed Trinity, as they say of one Matinius that was continually encompassed with the glorious light, either of the whole Trinity or of some glorious person of the Trinity, as he said of a Jesuit that he lay a long time in prison because during his lifetime he had not earnestly desired to see the glorious Trinity. They shall never make me believe that God will discover or reveal to any Jesuit of them all what he denied to his servant Moses. If Moses said, let me see you, and God said, no, then John Arrowsmith says, then no Jesuit has seen God. I come to what is more for edification, to refute the great disputers of this world, and especially the Arminians, that speak as if they were privy to the counsels of God and had a scientifical vision here below, and therefore will believe no more than what they can bring within the compass of their own reason, not considering what Job says in Job 33:12-13, "Behold, in this you are not just. I will answer you that God is greater than man. Why do you strive against him? For he gives not account of any of his matters." Two queries are made by Paul that might stop the mouths of all over-curious querists in the world. "Nay, but, O man, who are you that replies against God?" There are too many that are ready to reply against God, to chop logic with their maker. When they will not believe what God reveals, because they cannot fathom it. 1 Corinthians 1:20. Where is the wise and the scribe and the disputer of this world? The disputer of this world, and emphatically of this world, because there will be no disputing in the next world. Then comes the day of revelation of the righteous judgments of God, as Paul speaks in Romans 2, when God will make it apparent to every man that whatsoever he has said is true, and so what whatsoever he has done is just. Whether we can believe the truth of the one and consent to the justice of the other, yea or no. Therefore, it is good to take the counsel of Augustine. Will you be disputing with me? Rather wonder with me and cry, oh, the depth. Let us, both you and I, agree in fearing and trembling at the counsels of God, lest we both perish for our curiosity in searching too far into them. And of all disputers, none more guilty in this kind than the Arminians. Therefore, I name them. Men that take upon them to state the decrees of God as if they had been of his counsel when he made them. Men that seem to wade where Paul was past his depth, which made him cry, oh, the depth! They make it clear to you, to give you a reason of all God's decrees, if you take for granted what they say. If you ask them why Peter was elected and Judas not, they say, because God foresaw Peter would believe and Judas not. Why Peter was saved and Judas not? Because Judas willed to persevere in sin and Peter did not. Are not here men of God's counsel that leave nothing unsearched? Says Paul when he was discoursing of these high points in Romans 9, it is written, Jacob have I loved, and Esau have I hated. What shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? God forbid. He speaks as a man puzzled and nonplussed at the thoughts of this, how God should come to choose Jacob and hate Esau. He saw no unrighteousness with God. God has done it, and therefore just. And yet these people speak as if they could have fetched Paul out of his nonplus, which is but to say that God foresaw that Jacob would believe and Esau would not. Therefore, he loved the one and hated the other. So as a man, according to this reckoning, may learn more in Arminius' school in a few days than Paul had learned in the third heavens. Let us take this for a conclusion. As God cannot be seen in his essence, so not known in his counsels to any man on this side of heaven. The second use is this. No man has seen God at any time. Why then? Or not why then as in give me a reason, but he's exclaiming, why then or so then? Let us all from hence be set to long for heaven, where we shall enjoy that which is not attainable by any man here below, a sight of God, a beatifical sight, a scientifical sight. You shall have them both there in one place. 1 Corinthians 13, 12-13, now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. There is the beatifical vision of God. Now I know in part, but then I shall know even as also I am known. There is the scientifical vision of God. St. John tells you in another place a speech that might set the hearts of the people of God a-leaping within them for joy to think of that day. 1 John 3, verse 2, beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it does not yet appear what we shall be. But we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Who would not long for this day and for this appearance? When he shall appear, we shall see him as he is. No day so joyful as this to the people of God. The Sabbath, that is a joyful day. Therefore, the saints have learned to call the Sabbath a delight, as it is in Isaiah. Behold here, a rest for the people of God. An eternal Sabbath, a Sabbath that has no working day after it, a Sabbath which whosoever has once arrived at shall rest from his labors forevermore. It was a joyful day that when the people of Israel passed over Jordan and got into the land of Canaan, which they had been so long looking for. Think of that spiritual Canaan, of which the other was but a type, flowing with better milk and honey in likeness to God and vision of God. We shall be like him and see him as he is. If Moses longed for that, think what cause the people of God have to long for the other, because there they shall have the sight of God. The year of Jubilee was a joyful time before the appearing of Christ. When we shall be restored to that we fell from in Adam, we shall partake of the glorious liberty of the sons of God, as the apostle speaks. But that which is so joyful is the sight of God, which cannot be attained till then. the very sight of Christ in the flesh afforded much joy. Simeon got him in his arms and desired to die. Now let thy servant depart in peace, for mine eyes have seen your salvation. The Greeks in John 12, they came to Philip and said, Sir, we would see Jesus. It was a joyful sight to see Christ even in the flesh. What is it then to see Christ in his glory and God in his essence, as far as a finite creature can be capable of such a sight? If the disciples upon the mount were so overjoyed with the sight of Christ and two glorified creatures with him, Moses and Elijah, so as Peter forgot himself there, what joy will there be in the souls of men that come to see Christ attended with 1,000 times 10,000 saints and angels, not Christ transfigured, but Christ in his utmost glory? Wonder not if I speak but as one stuttering of these things, for all words come short. Let us make it up in affections. Learn to long for this sight and for that place where it is attainable. But then take this with you before I leave the point. Be careful as you desire to have that which you cannot attain here, a beatifical and scientifical sight of God. Be careful to walk in purity and in peace, for the sight of God is promised upon these conditions. First, in purity, Matthew 5:8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. It is not for every eye to see God. The pure in heart, they shall see him. Sore eyes cannot endure to see the light. Impure souls shall never be honored with the sight of God. The Jews whom Christ was speaking to here were men that stood much upon legal purifications. He puts them off from them and says, blessed are the pure in heart. A man that was not legally pure might not come to see God in the sanctuary. So will moral uncleanness much more keep us from the sight of God in heaven. Walk in purity. Second, in peace. So says the apostle, Hebrews 12:14. Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. As not without holiness, so not without peace. He that hopes to see the Prince of Peace in another world to his comfort must carry the Son of Peace here. That of Augustine is an excellent speech which he writes concerning this subject of seeing God in his 112th epistle, where he had disputed largely about this thing. He takes himself off and says, let us be wise to sobriety and not be too full of heat. In the carrying on of this argument, let us dispute fairly, lest while we speak in a way of contention and bitterness how God may be seen, we lose that peace without which God cannot be seen. Follow peace and holiness, without which it is impossible to see the Lord. Well, now you know why when I was preparing for this, I said, all right, here it is. This is all we need to do. Read this section from John Arrowsmith. Because he takes us through the different ways that it can be said that God is seen and how we cannot have that sight of God here on earth, but we will have it in heaven. And so he's not denying a true knowledge of God before that time. He's acknowledging that the limited nature of seeing God before that time and the plenitude, the fullness of the joy and blessing of seeing God when he makes us perfect, first in soul and then in body and ultimately consummating our nature. And I thought it was helpful the way that he shows how he used these truths to reprove some of the errors of the papists and the Arminians, but also he used it for personal application to Christians and even reproved us for our failings in certain things and gave us reasonable and applicable warnings for Christians. So when we confess that God is invisible, this is a very faithful exposition of what that means, and you can take it with you. So thanks for your attention. That will conclude our Sunday school.